Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert McChesney. Bob is a leading media scholar, critic, and activist. He's professor of communication downstate from me. I'm in Chicago. He's down in the Champaign-Urbana area in southern Illinois, a lot south of where I am in Chicago. Bob's a prolific writer. He's a frequent speaker. I've read most of his books. His new one absolutely is a must-read. I recommend all Bob's books. I think they're all must-reads. Bob, I just want to mention something from your last book. I think it was your last book. Maybe I missed one in between. But your book titled Communication Revolution, you noted a critical juncture that wouldn't, at the time, remain open for long. You called it an unprecedented window of opportunity to create a communication system that will be a more powerful impetus for a more egalitarian, humane, sustainable, and creative society. Indeed, you added more at the time. You believed at the time that the corporate stranglehold over our media system is very much in jeopardy. Well, your new book certainly has a much different opinion, Bob. It's called Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Away from Open Democracy, and you paint a picture that certainly is a lot different from that moment a few years ago that you thought activists had a chance to really capitalize on this critical juncture and get what it looks like the corporate types are taking away from us. Bob, welcome. You can explain it a lot better than I can.
Stephen, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for the kind words. You know, I don't think my perspective on the politics is much different. I think we're still in a critical juncture, and in the book I outlined 6, 7, 8 major policy fights that are active and current right now that could change dramatically for the better the course of the Internet. What I do think has changed, though, two things that have really changed qualitatively what we're looking at. One, the Internet has crystallized as an area of capitalist profitability in the last 5 or 6 years dramatically. You know, we've seen now that we have a number of companies with these sort of network monopolies, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, eBay, Microsoft. These are gigantic companies making enormous amounts of money. Some of them were making enormous amounts of money, you know, in 2006. But some of them have really mushroomed, especially the social media ones, since then. And they're almost all monopolies in the economic sense of the term. And because of this, there's much more consolidated capitalist power on the other side of the ledger driving the system. And that raises the degree of difficulty for reformers than it was 6 or 7 years ago. The second factor is related to it, is that now we have a situation where the Internet economy is at the heart of modern capitalism. And it means that if you go down the list of the 32 most valuable publicly traded companies in the United States today, I think 14 of them are Internet-related companies, Internet-slash-media-related companies. And to give some sense of comparison, only 3 of the top 32 are banks. You know, the 2 big-to-fail banks we talk about owning the government. Well, there's a lot more Internet companies that really dominate everything economically now, and where capitalism is putting all its chips for the future, where they're investing. And what this means, again, is that it makes the degree of difficulty to change the Internet much higher, because it's now in the bone marrow and the central nervous system of the political economy, the existing institutions. But it also then points the way out, and that's the argument of the book, which is when we're talking about really making an Internet that serves democracy, that serves democratic values, that is subject to democratic control, we're also really talking about changing the whole political economy of the country. It is invariably, this is the argument I reach at the end of the book, to be blunt and to be honest, we're talking about changing the way the American economy works and going away from the type of capitalism we've known for the last several generations in a very different direction.
Well, Bob, I certainly agree with that. We literally are in the grip of corporate power that gets more consolidated, more powerful. It's in league, cooperatively with government. It doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They both operate exactly the same way, Bob. Obama, George Bush, literally makes no difference. And I think I agree with your notion that there is nothing more important than controlling the message to people. If you can control it, if you can control what people hear and read and see, you can literally manipulate their opinions. And this makes media control, again, controlling the message, the most important thing of all. I talk about money power being so important, but if people, there's an old Henry Ford quote that goes back a century or more where he says something to the effect that if people knew the half of what was going on back then, Bob, there was a shadow of what's going on today, there'd be a revolution in the morning. I think he was talking about bankers. Well, people can find out what's going on. Even with the corporate grip on the internet, people can go to reliable websites. You need to make a little effort, but it doesn't really take much. My fear, Bob, is that the freedoms that we have now are slowly eroding, and I wonder if another book you'll write maybe 4 or 5 years from now will paint an even more dire picture than what you fear is going on today.
Well, yeah, I think it's bad enough now that we don't have to wait 5 years to get off our dust, but I agree the trajectory right now, barring policy intervention change, is very much for the worse. And you know, I think just that comment you made, Stephen, in question has so much material packed into it to really do justice to what you're talking about, because it's much of the whole book is based on some of those ideas. You know, I think one of the reasons why people are not especially alarmed by the internet and what's happening there or paying attention to it is that, yeah, for each of us, and I suspect everyone who's listening, it's certainly true of myself, and I bet it's true of you, Stephen, you know, I don't go online hunting out advertising or really crappy websites or garbage. I've got a sort of grooved path of a handful of websites I go to that I trust, that are reliable. You know, I get emails from friends. You know, I have friends who, you know, active on Facebook and Twitter who are very happy with the communities they've got there. So in a way, you can carve out your little world and put a wall around it and say, hey, everything's great here. This is sort of better than it used to be before the internet. Life is good, and now it's just up to everyone else to find their own groovy little world. And once we all have our groovy little worlds, we're going to make a groovy big world. The problem with that is that it looks like we're in this information rainforest from which people create their groovy world. But in some ways, we're really in an information desert. What I mean by that is, in terms of journalism, content, news, you know, we're seeing a freefall collapse, a thoroughgoing disintegration of resources going to produce what was considered journalism, not in the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon. It's probably worse in the United States. The internet didn't cause this crisis, but it has greatly accelerated it. And made it irreversible. And the bottom line, and it's quite appropriately to use that expression, is that corporations, businesses, entrepreneurs no longer think you can make money doing journalism, so they stopped investing in it. And they're going to lay people off, and that's the direction we're going. It's going directly to the bottom. And that's not just print media, that's everywhere. There's no hope of making viable, credible commercial journalism online. And the reason for that is that journalism is basically a public good. It's never been something, popular democratic journalism, that is, not journalism for elites. It's never been something that the market has been able to produce in sufficient quality or quantity. In the beginning of American history, for the first 100 years, this was hidden, this was masked by the fact that there were enormous postal and printing subsidies by the federal government, which really subsidized journalism and made it a mass popular undertaking. For the last 125 years, the public good nature of journalism was hidden because advertising provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues, not final readers or viewers of news media. And so it gave the illusion that journalism was a commercially viable undertaking because there was all this ad money. Well, now advertising is abandoning journalism. As you can online, it's completely jumped ship because we now have a whole new age of advertising. I write about this in the book. It's not really well understood yet and appreciated what this means. This new era of advertising is one in which advertisers no longer buy media and place ads on media. It's not like the old days where you'd buy an ad in a newspaper. And then the newspaper would take some of the proceeds from the ad to pay for editorial content to attract readers. So the advertising was subsidizing the journalism. And they do that for entertainment content as well on television and radio. Nowadays, when an advertiser goes online, it buys demographics. It basically says we want to get 30 million exposures to women 18 to 29 who live in the suburbs and might be interested in buying an automobile. We want them in the next 4 hours. And an ad network will deliver those millions of women wherever they are online, whatever website they're at. They don't have to be at a media website. They could be at the Best Buy or the Target website. And these ad networks basically keep most of the money for these ads. And the actual medium itself, the website where the ads end up running, just get pennies on the dollar compared to what they used to get. As a result, you just can't make money off of advertising during content. It's a whole different type of advertising. And, Steve, there's one other factor, and this gets to the changes going online. For that system to work, what we've evolved online is that we've turned the Internet on its head. Back in the 1990s, and still in a lot of the popular rhetoric about the Internet, the idea was the Internet was a great equalizer. It was going to treat everyone as equal. They came in anonymous. They could see the same material as everyone else, poor people and rich people. For the first time, really, we're on a level playing field. And it would be the end of big corporate monopolies, the end of tyrannical governments, the end of militarism and propaganda, because people would be able to get the truth, and sort of corrupt, illicit, concentrated power would be jeopardized, if not eliminated. And what's happened online is that we've changed that logic almost entirely. It's almost in a 180-degree turn. And I think Google and Facebook are the best examples of what I mean by that. These are companies that, for the most part, give their product away for free. And so then you say, how do they make money? Well, if you get something for free on the Internet, Steve, you're not the customer. You are the product. And basically what's happened online is all the users of the Internet have become the product for corporate America. And what they have a value about us is they know everything we do online. You have no anonymity anymore. You have no privacy anymore. You basically, there are scores of companies led at the top by Microsoft, AOL, Yahoo, and especially Google and Facebook and Amazon. They just have a wealth of material about everything you do online, and then they can tailor advertising and tailor content just for you. So it's an individual experience, all done to try to maximize the ability to sell you stuff, to sell advertising, place advertising on whatever websites you go to. And the premise of this is they just happen everything. The notion that you are anonymous, that you're private when you go online, those days are over. They're gone. And they're not coming back unless we have a radical change in the Internet, which probably means a radical change in our society.
Oh, indeed, true, Bob. I understand what you mean by people being the product and getting a service free. I spent most of my time in small family business, and we began back in the 1960s by putting on job fairs. We called them career fairs. We called them a few things. Career fairs. It was it matched up exiting junior military officers, leaving the Vietnam situation, coming back to civilian life, and we matched them up with the big corporations that wanted to meet them and hire them. It was wonderful for the corporations. It was wonderful for these young men, mostly men, women if they had the qualifications. If we could meet them back in those days, it was mostly men, and indeed the candidates were the product for the corporations, and it was a marvelous marriage of bringing the two together. I think we were one of the first ever to do something like this, and then it changed over the years. I've been out of it for a good many years. I don't know what's going on now, but I do understand exactly what you're talking about. The monopolization by the profit-making corporations, Bob, that is indeed very, very troubling. And the carpet bombing us with advertising, whether it's on TV, whether it's online, however they give it to us, and the stories that they cover, they try their best to block out other sources that don't get the eyeballs or the readership or whatever that they get. So we get a one-sided story. Nothing reflects it right now in the headlines than the so-called Boston bombing story. I grew up in Boston. I know exactly where this incident took place. I spent enough time there myself. But you're only getting one side of the story. You don't hear the other side of the story. And at best, there are very disturbing questions that haven't been answered, and you certainly won't get the corporate giants doing it.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, but I would go back to say, though, returning to the point I was trying to make earlier, and I didn't finish, In my view, one of the great existential crises online is the fact that journalism is disintegrating. So we think there's this blizzard of information about everything. As long as we have a good ability to use a search engine and the patience to look long and hard enough, we'll find it out there. And what I would submit to you is, no, it's not out there because it's not being done. If you look at the last election, for example, in 2012, if you lived in the middle of Kentucky or any place in this country, you could search to your heart's delight, and you would not find credible, meaningful journalism on the vast majority of political races in this country. It just didn't exist, no matter how many pages of Google search you went to, because there's no one really covering in any sort of intelligent way politics in this country, because that costs money. And even the coverage we got at the presidential level, or maybe for statewide races, was generally completely inane, so it was next to worthless. So my point is that having access to the Internet doesn't mean you have access to all you need. It's not being produced. And this goes to a classic example. Oftentimes WikiLeaks is held up as well. That proves it. We've got the Internet now. The man's in trouble. We can expose his crimes, and he's cooked. We've got WikiLeaks. That proves the Internet has solved the problem, and we can live happily ever after. In fact, WikiLeaks is exhibit A for the argument I'm making, because what WikiLeaks was able to do was make public all sorts of extraordinary public government documents, which should have been public in the first place, which were kept secret to cover up government malfeasance, corruption, and the truth, basically, about what's going on in the world that the public was not supposed to know. And just releasing those documents was meaningless, absolutely meaningless. It meant nothing. Most Americans, including myself, have no idea what's in most of those documents, and I will never know because I don't have time to go through. I don't have time to take a sabbatical, quit my job with 5,000 other people and go through all those documents and make sense of them. That's just not part of my future life, and I'm interested in what's in there. For most Americans, that's simply never even thinkable. So what we need is journalism. What we need are journalists who are actually paid in competing newsrooms, accountable for what they do, studying these to make sense of what's happening in them. I mean, that's what's lacking. Having 30 billion documents online incoherently organized means nothing to anyone unless journalists go in and make sense of it. And that's what we've lost. We've lost competing newsrooms trying to break a story, cover it, accountable for it, that's really getting after it and pushing a story along. And for that reason, WikiLeaks has had very little effect in the United States because only a handful of journalists really went into it originally, and since then, the government / corporate media combined PR campaign to demonize WikiLeaks has been so successful. Now, most journalists would never even consider doing it. The handful of journalists who still have jobs.
And, Bob, the journalists that went into it from the major media, New York Times, Washington Post, whatever, actually, New York Times, I remember writing an article about this or including it in an article, that they went through whatever number of documents they reviewed, but they before they published an article on it, they reviewed it with the administration to be sure there was nothing embarrassing that would be in their article. So you've got a gatekeeper for the establishment, and whatever they discover that may have been really what ordinary people want to know, they made sure we didn't find it out.
That's right. But to circle back to what the moral of the story is that we need independent journalists in competing newsrooms with muscle so they can stand up to the government and do the right thing. And we have very little, none of that. We only have a handful of journalists in America today who operate by those principles, and they're living hand to mouth. It's a social problem. It's a political problem of the highest magnitude. When the founders started this country, and they were not perfect. I'm not one of these infallible framer people. But one thing they were really smart about, and they understood from the historical experience of looking at other efforts to have self-government, they understood you had to have, the first duty of the democratic state was to make sure you had a credible, independent, free press. And you couldn't just assume it would happen. It was as important as establishing a credible, independent, free press as it was establishing the Bill of Rights or Congress or the court system. Without a credible, independent, free press, everything else would be meaningless. And Jefferson and Madison were adamant about this. This was not something they put in a footnote. They wrote about it endlessly. And that's why we instituted these spectacularly huge postal subsidies and printing subsidies, which spawned a vastly larger popular press than ever would have existed if it had just been left to commercial interests. It wasn't even considered an option to just let rich people make money and hope we got lucky. Though that sort of talk didn't come for over a century that anyone would even think in those terms, or until the corporations and the large commercial concerns dominated newspaper publishing in the early 20th century. And we've got to return to that sort of thinking. That's one of the arguments, one of several I make in the book. We've got to understand this is a social problem. We've got to find a way to get hundreds of thousands of people incomes in independent, competing newsrooms so they're covering their communities, covering the world, so we have the information and tools we need to actually engage in self-government. Because right now, those institutions are just disintegrating before our eyes, and we're just left with a lot of, a blizzard, but no coherence.
Well, Bob, I say the same things in some of my articles. I say it on air. We're competing against these major corporations that reach millions of people. And you write marvelous books, Bob, and, of course, you teach down at the University of Illinois. Well, you reach a small number of people compared to the millions that the major corporations reach through their media messages. So how do we communicate to people and let them know the urgency of what you're saying? How do we convince people that this stuff going on now is so harmful to our own welfare? If we don't do something about it, as bad as things are now, it's only going to get worse and worse and worse. And when will people wake up? When it's too late? Now, years ago was the time to act, but certainly now is the time to act. But I'm frustrated by this. Maybe this program reaches thousands of people, but it doesn't reach millions, and you don't reach millions, and other people like you, Bob, the good guys, telling the story, setting the record straight, discussing and writing about the things that people need to know most. How do we reach enough people to convince them that it's up to us to do something, and if we don't, it's Katie by the door?
Well, that's one of the reasons why media reform and exactly what I've been talking about is so important. It's not something that's sort of a side part of democratic renewal. It's right at the heart of democratic renewal. It's not the only thing we do. There's lots of other stuff we could talk about, but getting the resources for independent, and I would say non-commercial, non-profit journalism, is really at the center of progressive political fights. Now, I'm not a pessimist at all, and I'm sometimes criticized for this. And the reason I'm not a pessimist is that I think everything's going great, and all we have to do is sit back with our iPhones and text each other and live happily ever after. Rather, I'm an optimist because the vast majority of Americans, from my personal experience and from survey data, are really on my side, on our side, on most of these issues when they're actually presented these issues and have a chance to think about them. And the more they know about these issues, the more strongly they are on our side. So I think we're dealing with, I'd be much more depressed and I'd be despondent if I thought the vast majority of people opposed me no matter what, that I'm just a hopeless minority, like some sort of, religious sect. But no, I think that, the values I stand for, the argument I'm making, that you're doing, that this being on this network, actually have tremendous resonance. And the crisis in our times in America today is that our political system is so corrupted, it's so owned and operated by powerful corporate interests that, the ideas that people are in favor of don't even get a hearing unless they're sanctioned by some corporation. So my frequent co-author and friend John Nichols has a term he uses. He calls them zombie ideas. He says that we'll have elections in which people will adamantly vote, that they don't want Social Security messed with or Medicare messed with. Yet as soon as the election's over, here come both political parties returning with a zombie idea that the people don't want but the corporate interests are pushing. Or austerity. The elections basically say the voters don't want these crazy austerity programs that have been proven to do nothing but destroy economies and help rich people in the short term. And, we have elections and Obama and Democrats get elected basically not being the party of austerity. And then as soon as they get back into office, they return to policies of austerity unblinkingly. And so, that's the crisis, is that we have a democratic crisis, that our system is no longer responsive to the interests of the people. Well, that can get you depressed, but the good news there is we've got the numbers on our side if we disorganize. And that's what drives me, and it should drive everyone listening to this. When someone gets despondent, when someone has despair, you're doing exactly what the other side wants you to do. They want you to take yourself out of the game because they know their hold on the popular support is so tenuous that if they get you not playing the game, their chances of victory go way up And so it's, to me, this is a very important matter. And it's an issue we deal with a lot in America because Americans always feel like the power of those on top is so great and they're inundated in a corporate media system that makes it this is the only possible world and the best of all possible worlds and social change is impossible. And it's nonsense. It's one of the big lies of our times, but it's an overwhelming tidal wave message that we get, so it's easy to fall prey to it, and everyone has fallen prey to it to a certain extent. But I'll just tell you one quick story. I'll give you two stories, actually, Steve, that address this. And one is a friend of mine, is a South African, a white South African, is a professor of mine in graduate school, and he emigrated to the United States in the 1960s. Anti-apartheid, very liberal politically, and he left South Africa in part because he hated apartheid, didn't want to live in that sort of society. And his family, though, who had lived in South Africa for centuries, both English and Afrikaans, his family had stayed in South Africa. I talked to him in 1987. I went in his office, and he said he was very down, and he said, my entire family is selling all their property, their houses, everything, cashing out, and they're leaving South Africa forever. They say it's hopeless. They will never get rid of apartheid in South Africa. The white minority government is simply would rather have a bloodbath and kill millions than give up power. It's an absolutely hopeless situation. After 300 years, they've given up, or 100 years of battling apartheid. And that was in 1987. 3 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and a couple of years after that, he was president of South Africa. I mean, so in 1987, it looked like a thousand years of apartheid was in front of them, mixed with bloodbath. In 1992 or 3, Nelson Mandela was president of South Africa, and there's democratic one person, one vote majority rule. And just in our own country, we've had this conversation. Have people forgotten what happened in 2011? Is our memory hole sunk that is so pathetic that we don't even remember that just 2 years ago, this time in the city of Madison, where right now I'm sitting, and every day there were demonstrations that went on for 6 weeks, impromptu demonstrations at the state capitol, which was occupied with 5 to 10 to 15,000 people on weekends. People came from all over the state. We had 100,000, 150,000 people here a couple of times. And this is like some of the most intelligent, thoughtful, passionate people I've ever seen in my life. Now, we've forgotten about that, like it didn't happen, but it did happen. I was there, and if you were there, you understood what was going on. There is a deep wellspring of democratic commitment and progressivism and humanity in this country that's been repressed and marginalized. It's just waiting to explode. And our job is basically to bring that to life.
Bob, I remember what happened in Madison. I wrote many, many articles about it. Public workers rallying and people supporting public workers. They occupied the Capitol. They wanted to save their jobs. They wanted to save their benefits. It was a heroic struggle. I guess it's still going on. I mean, they were beaten back, but it's still going on. They won at least one court decision, but the dark forces fight back all the time. I agree with what you said earlier. I phrase it in terms of not losing hope. I refuse to lose hope. Hope literally drives me to do what I do every day. And in America, Bob, just on a national basis, impossible things happen. We ended slavery. We got labor rights. We got civil rights. We now have wage slavery replacing chattel slavery. Civil and labor rights have largely eroded because the energy of the spirit that drove the reform, it wanes and things go back to the way it was. But it proves, Bob, that it doesn't take a majority. When enough committed people decide they simply won't put up with the status quo, we literally have the power to change things.
You're right, Stephen. We're getting a little far afield from the book per se, but not really, because this pertains to the difficulty we have of changing things. And it does return, it circles back to the corruption of the governing process, which no longer represents the interests of the people. In fact, there was a couple of major studies that were released by academic presses last year, Princeton University Press.
Well, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to let you wrap up very quickly.
Well, just that these surveys, remember, leading political scientists in America, and they did long examinations of how governance worked in the United States, and they basically concluded that working class, middle class, poor people in America have virtually no influence over the government of this country. Government decisions are made virtually entirely based on the interest of moneyed interest, the 1 or 2%. We're a democracy. in the weakest form in name only.
Bob, I've got to wrap it up. I want to mention your book again, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Away from Democracy. Bob, I strongly recommend it. I urge listeners to get a copy and read the book. And I urge them all the time on this program to get informed, spread the word, get involved. It's amazing the power that we have. Bob, I look forward to getting you back.
My pleasure, Steve. Good luck with everything.
Thank you, Bob. Join us this weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.